The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 465 for Tuesday, September 10th, 2013.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in questions, tips, answers. We send in questions, tips, and answers. That's not how it goes. The show where you send in questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We provide some answers along with some questions of our own from time to time. We share your tips. We share your cool stuff found. And we also talk about the things that interest us from time to time as well. Today, here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And today, and probably tomorrow, here in Fearful, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
John F. Braun. How are you doing today, John F. Braun?
Fantastic.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. It's good. It's good. So today, I have not watched the video yet because the video didn't come out early enough for me to actually watch it before we recorded this show. But I followed along with the live streams and everything. It is the 10th of Tuesday, September. I'm just going to confuse things today. It's just how it's going to be. So I'm okay with it. Are you guys okay with it? Hopefully. And so Apple just finished doing their iPhone 5S and 5C announcement in Cupertino, California. And so we'll talk a little bit about that here, John, because I'm sure we both have some thoughts about it. I think it was interesting. I'm curious to watch it, I think, but I think I got the gist of it, including sort of the unspoken stuff as it cooked along. So two iPhones, right? John, this is interesting. They announced two new iPhones, but they did it even though it seems different, it's actually the same thing it's always been with a twist, right? When the iPhone 5 was announced, they made the iPhone 4 free with a 2-year contract, and then the iPhone 4S was $99 with a 2-year contract, and then of course the iPhone 5 was $199, $299, $399, depending on how big you wanted the thing to be. They did the same thing here. So the iPhone 4S now becomes free with a 2-year contract. And the iPhone 5 is no longer for sale. But the iPhone 5C, which is a new product whose specs mostly match the iPhone 5, takes its place at the $99 price slot, or $199 if you want a little bigger. And then, of course, the iPhone 5S, $199, $299, $399. And that's how it goes. So interesting stuff. Have you taken a look at some of the videos, John, and the pictures of the new 5C? Because that one, it's a different look.
It certainly is. So, yeah. So I followed the various commentaries on the Twitters. So I think I get it. And yeah, I would say the 5C. So first, the info that leaked was, for the most part, almost entirely accurate.
That's right. Yeah.
The 5C, I would say, is probably the biggest, largest deviation here. I mean, it almost reminds me kind of the funky iMacs that they came out with at one point. And that I think one of the keys here, and if you watch the video, there will be another Johnny Ive video that you'll find as well, where he's talking about the form and the function and
yep.
the colors and the things like that. And depending on, you know, your visual receptors here, you may love them or hate them. But I think they're targeting a different market here with the C.
Yeah, I think so. It doesn't take a genius. And I say that because I can figure it out to see that the 5C is really geared towards, or partially at least geared towards, the Chinese market. But in watching the video, I really got the feeling that the 5C is like the physical embodiment of iOS 7, right? I mean, it's got the same colors. It you know, the phone now feels the same inside and out with iOS 7 on it. I think it's a good thing. Like you said, it's back to the days of the candy colored iMacs, that whole thing. I think it's cool. And you know, we've seen Apple sort of go up and down for, you know, with those colors. They do them for a while, then they back off, then they do them in a different product line and they back off. But it's cool because when I first saw it, I thought the 5C was just like an iPhone 5 or something similar with a plastic shell around it. That is not the case. The shell is the plastic is the body of this thing. They do reinforce it with some metal, but that metal then becomes the antennas. So, and then they build the phone's guts inside this plastic shell. So it really is just, you know, as you see it. And I'm curious to hold one. I think they'll probably be pretty nice to hold. Perhaps even nicer than the 5 and the 5S, because I don't know, the metal thing isn't my thing, but you know, whatever.
That's yeah. Okay. And they said, again, in the, you know, the kind of, you know, in industrial design video there, they said it's plastic. We'll admit.
It's plastic. Yeah, they called it polycarbonate.
Polycarbonate.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. It's a nice way of saying plastic.
Yeah. It may, I don't know, that may help it make it a little tougher for, you know, people that like to drop their phones and
yeah,
stuff
because
like that.
I'm assuming the 5S, like the 5, is made of, it's a composite material. It's actually an especially mixed alloy of aluminum, balsa wood, and chocolate. Is what the outside of the iPhone 5 is. Yeah, no, if you ever took a butter knife and just, like, you could just get the butter knife close to it and maybe move it up and down. You don't even have to touch it with it, and it'll get all scratched and everything, and it'll get dinged up if you drop it, like, into some change on your pocket or something. Don't drop it more than an inch in your pocket onto some change, because it'll get dinged up. So, yeah, it's a very special material. I'm thinking the 5C is probably made out of something a little bit more rugged. Can you tell I'm not happy with the material of the iPhone 5, John?
5C or 5S?
No, the 5. Well, and presumably the 5S. Yeah, I mean, I think the 5 and the 5S are made out of the same thing. I'll still get a 5S. So let's talk about this 5S, because it's an interesting, I'm excited about this for possibly surprising reasons. The biggest thing for me in the 5S is the camera. If it delivers even half of what they've promised here, it is so good for idiots like me with cameras. I'm just not a camera guy. You know, I spent time learning other things, but I like to take pictures some of the time. And what Apple's doing, merging hardware and software together with that thing, is they're essentially making it so that in the end, you press, you know, the shutter button and you get a better picture than you would have previously. And that's the goal. It's like it. I see it as a step down their path that they started with HDR mode in the iPhone 4, right, John? Where they have it take two pictures, and then you can choose between those two. This is now taking like four pictures and picking the sharpest elements and merging them together and coming up with the best picture for you. Which I think is awesome. I'm totally stoked about that. And then, yes, the optics are a little bit better, but only incrementally. Maybe does that make all the difference? I don't think so. I think a lot of it is in the software and the circuitry inside the phone.
Yeah. At one point they mentioned the aperture. I think it was 2.2F or something like that. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, they're going to introduce aperture.
No.
A new aperture. But no, they didn't.
No.
It was totally an iPhone event. Now, the one thing that strikes me as unusual, and I don't know why they touted it or what their goal is here.
Yeah.
So, of course, they now claim, and I think it may be for marketing reasons, but they're like, oh, it's the first 64-bit iPhone. So it's an A7 processor.
That's right.
And it's a 64-bit smartphone. And I'm really scratching my head over why they decided to do this, because I am not clear on an iPhone class device what the benefit is of having a 64-bit processor.
Yeah, I was trying to think, are they doing like this image processing and stuff in a way where 64 bits, you know, having a 64-bit path would make it faster, you know, more efficient to do that?
Well, the thing is, so 64 bits does two things for you. Very high level view here. I know it does a lot.
Yeah, let's keep it. That's good.
So the one thing, a 64-bit processor or architecture does give you the capability to access more memory than a 32-bit processor. But at this point in time, I don't believe there is really an iPhone that can take advantage of accessing memory beyond, I think it's 4 gigabytes. So I question that. And then the thing is 64.
So I think iPhones, well, at least the iPhone 5, I think, has 1 gig of RAM in it. Right. And there's some speculation that the 5S would have 2. So,
right.
But still, to your point. Yeah.
And I even saw some developers saying it's not for the memory, at least at this point in time.
Right.
It's not for accessing more memory. And then 64-bit software doesn't necessarily, though it can, but it doesn't necessarily run faster than 32-bit software. It could for certain things, but it may not. In some cases, it actually may be slower because now you have 64-bit registers versus 32-bit registers. So I think they're doing this maybe one just for the marketing, saying, hey, look, we got a 64-bit processor. And number two is that down the road, as they upgrade the other parts of the phone to 64-bit, then we may see the benefit of it. So so I don't think now it really makes a big difference that it's 64-bit. I think, and it should, like most other migrations to 64-bit, it'll run 32-bit code.
Right. Yeah, of course. So another thing about the 5S I wanted to talk about, John, which, you know, factors into some of the threads of conversation we've been having here on the show, is the what Apple's calling Touch ID, which is their fingerprint recognition or authentication process. And it's interesting. If you watch it's a video about the 5S and it's only maybe 4 minutes long. Did you watch it, John, or no?
I did see, I saw the screenshots and all that. So I get what they're doing. It's nothing new.
Right. Well, let me explain it because I missed this until I watched the video. So let me explain what they're doing. It, to the user, there are two things that can happen with Touch ID. One is that when you put your finger that you've previously set up over the or onto the home button, it unlocks and wakes up your phone, which is totally convenient. And I like that. The other thing that they're having it do out of the gate is you can set it up so that your fingerprint can then also authenticate you for App Store purchases, which is also awesome. Right. I mean, it totally convenient the way it's done, though, because I was concerned, as I'm sure we all are. I'm crazy about protecting my fingerprints and especially protecting my kids' fingerprints. I just won't let them put them anywhere because once that data gets compromised, there's no getting it back. It is Pandora's box. You can't change your fingerprint like you can your password, right? So,
without spending a lot of money.
Yeah.
And we're getting some sandpaper.
Right. Yeah. Or some whatever, hydrochloric acid. But yes. Okay. So, what Apple says is that your signature data, A, is never leaves your iPhone. And B is stored inside, and they put this in caps in their press release. It's stored inside a secure enclave in the iPhone's A7 chip. So there is some secure storage. It's encrypted and then stored there onboard the chip. So it's not even in RAM. It's, nowhere that in theory any third party app could get to it. But here's the interesting part. Unlocking it, I get it. That's a root level function. But the App Store, that's not that. That's just an app, right? And we've seen other apps install apps, right? Like you can do with hockey app or test flight if you're testing software. So the App Store is just a regular app, but it gets to use private APIs. And I'm nearly certain that there is a private API where an app can go to the phone and say, hey, will you authenticate that this user is who they say they are by using their thumbprint or their fingerprint? And the phone will do it and then either return yay or nay back, to the app, and then they're unlocked and good to go. And I can totally see that being this, one of Apple's, like the camera, right? Slowly marching down this path, iterating as they go carefully. And then it becomes a way to like use your iTunes store account to pay for stuff at Starbucks or at a vending machine, right? I mean, this whole mobile micropayments thing, I think this is Apple's path down that, or Apple's trajectory down that path. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it opens the door to what we've seen happening slowly with certain people in the past, multi-factor authentication.
And yeah, but this is single factor authentication. It's not multi-factor. It's multiple choices.
Okay, hold on. I'm saying it opens the door for the potential. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
This is the what you are part of a multi-factor authentication system, which is what you know, what you are, and what you have. This is the what you are in that it's a biometric.
That's right.
Now, it introduces, though, some risks. So as we kind of suggested, if you get a cut or you burn yourself or something, your fingerprint may not work. And that's bad, though from what they said, is that you can use multiple fingers.
Five fingers out of the gate. It will store.
So unless you burn your entire hand or hurt it, and then, you know, of course, people were joking about, you know, in addition to someone stealing your iPhone, they would now have to cut off one or more of your fingers in order to be you. And I think they also mentioned that they do, which is part of fingerprint sensing, is that they do temperature sensing, because one of the classic attacks that some people have done in the past is called the gummy bear attack, which someone actually was able to defeat some of the early scanners by taking a gummy bear, putting it against their fingerprint, and then putting it on the device. And because the temperature, it didn't check the temperature, it was like, oh, that's you. Okay.
That's cool.
Actually, it was a gummy bear. So I've seen fingerprint scanners on various PCs, I think ThinkPads and some others, as an additional way, either multi-factor or just another way to, you know, unlock the machine.
So right,
It's cool to see. And I think people have speculated we may see it on the Mac.
I like it on mobile devices. And I hope that the next, you know, wave of iPads has this too, because the only time I put a passcode on my iPhone is when I'm traveling. And it's because it's inconvenient to have to type the thing. But when I'm traveling, I feel like, well, okay, it greater chance of me losing this, and there's data on it that, you know, probably shouldn't be spread around. So yes, I'll do it then. But with this, I would leave a passcode on it 100% of the time, because I just float my thumb over the button and it unlocks. And that's actually faster than what I do now, because I got to do the swipe thing.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Now, you brought up an interesting point. I want to ask you about this, but I think you had tweeted something earlier. So this, as far as I can tell, is a capacitive technology,
mm-hmm.
similar to the screen on the iPhone.
That's right.
And you had made this statement that certain cases may prohibit you from taking advantage of this.
Yeah. So
is that correct?
Well, I did tweet that, and I'll explain what I meant. I saw, you know, the new camera, makes me want my iPhone to be waterproof, right? And that's been true with every iPhone that I have. I want something that I can use outdoors. And we do a lot of vacations on the lake or by water. And I would just like to have the peace of mind that if I happen to drop this stupid thing while I'm taking a picture with it, I'm not out $600 or whatever it turns out to be. So I would, you know, when we travel, a lot of times I'll put a LifeProof or one of the Obex cases or whatever on my iPhone for exactly that reason. My guess is that you could make a film or a piece of glass or something that sat over the button that was part of the case that conducted enough of the fingerprint through that it would work. But the problem is you've got that there's a ring around the home button now that is conductive, and it senses when you've put your finger there, and that's when it turns on the sensors so as to save battery and all that good stuff. So that makes it very tricky, I would assume, for somebody like LifeProof to do this. Doesn't mean it's impossible. It just, you know, means current. I would imagine that current iPhone 5 cases, many of them will still work with the 5S. It looks to be the same size. Things look to be in the same spot, with the exception of the camera and the flash are a little bit bigger. So depending on how big the aperture is in the case, you may or may not, be able to use it. But a LifeProof case you could use it, but you probably have to type in a password. You couldn't use your thumbprint thing. So anyway, okay. that was my thought. I'm trying to think. One other thing that struck me as odd but is interesting. iPhone 5C pre-orders start on the 13th, which I believe is this Friday. iPhone 5C and 5S are released in stores on the 20th. There are no pre-orders for the iPhone S. If you want to order it, you can. And those orders start on the 20th, which is the same day that they're in the stores. My gut says that they're doing this to have more fanfare. You know, when people line up for the phone, all that stuff, there's a lot of news coverage. There's a lot of stories written. When they moved to the online pre-ordering, a lot of that went away, you know, for good reason. So I have to think that they want, you know, more press. And so that's why they're doing it. At least I can't think of a good reason otherwise.
All right.
Because it's a pain going. Imagine every single person in line has to, or half of them have to, you know, migrate their number over from, you know, their carrier or upgrade a phone. And so it's going to be this, you know, 5+ minute process per customer to get them to the point where they're ready to check out. And that's if you've got everything else right there. So I don't know. We'll see. What do you think, John?
I think I may have to upgrade my phone soon.
Yay. That would be good.
I think I may get a 4S.
Get the 5S. I will make a case specifically for you. My general advice to people is buy the best. And if you can't afford the best, buy the best you can afford, right? With computers, I modify that to buy the newest because you know it's going to be obsoleted quickly anyway. So you might as well, you know, get as far ahead of the curve as you can. And specifically for you, knowing how long you keep any gadgets or devices that you use, you're going to keep this thing for, you know, for probably what, a decade or two. So, yeah. So, you know, why start behind the eight ball? Get the fastest, best thing that you can. Maybe you don't need the 64 gig version. Maybe the 32 is good enough, but you know, otherwise I would say get the 5S. Why? I mean, you're probably talking about $100 delta here. It's not, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe I'll jump to the 5. Because the only thing I can't do right now is there are certain devices that I've actually.
There is no 5, by the way, right? You can jump to the 5S or the 5C, but you cannot get an iPhone 5 anymore.
But they still offer the 4S.
Yeah, but don't get the 4S, dude. Get something the right size screen. You know, I get the 5S.
The only thing I don't like about the 4 is that there are certain Bluetooth devices that will not work with the 4 because the 4 does not have a low energy Bluetooth chipset.
Yep.
And I've received a couple of devices for review and I tried to use them and I would try to download the software and the App Store would say, sorry, man, can't download the software.
This is why you need current stuff. You're making my point for me. So get the 5S and that way you'll have the longest tenure with that phone.
But the 5C is so colorful. Or does it stand for cheap? Or I don't know.
Get the 5S. Yeah. Get the 5S.
I'll get the 5S.
Gold color if you want. I like the gold color. I mean, I want to touch it, but
check it out.
I think it's good.
I actually submitted, one of the articles, you saw that, you know, one of the articles we showed how to step through the various stores, and I actually provided some screenshots on how to do this through the Verizon store. So they will actually throw some cash at you for your old phone.
Right.
Not a lot. I think it was like $65 or something like that. And unfortunately, which makes me shake my fist, at least at Verizon, I don't know if the other guys do this, is that they charge a $30 upgrade fee.
They all do.
Guys.
They all do.
They all do that now.
Yeah, it's a processing fee.
Okay, and then I think I'll lose my unlimited data, but I don't use a lot of data anyways.
You may or may not. Yeah, it depends.
Well, last I saw, and I can't find it anymore, but if you bought it for retail, then you could maintain your unlimited data plan, but then you're paying $650 for the phone at least.
Yeah. But I bet if you looked at your data, you would find that you probably don't need it.
I use maybe hundreds of megabytes a month. Yeah, I don't even reach any of the caps for the plans, which are typically gigabytes per month. Right. So,
all right. So this is it's a perfect time, in fact, to talk about our first sponsor, which is Gazelle.com. Gazelle is the place you go if you want to sell your iPhone, right? So, John, I would encourage you to go and check out what Gazelle's willing to pay you for your phone versus what Apple's willing to pay you. And what's cool is normally you can only lock in your price for 30 days. Right now, Gazelle is offering lock-ins extended all the way through October 15th. So what you do is you go right now, and I literally would stop what I was doing, except you can't because we're doing the podcast, but you'll do it anyway. So you go to gazelle.com, John, and you put in what you have, you know, your iPhone 4, whether it works or not, which of course we know yours does, how big it is, what carrier it's on, blah, blah, blah. And then Gazelle will give you a price. if and it costs you nothing to lock in this price. In fact, no money ever leaves your pocket. It leaves theirs and comes to you. But first, what comes to you is a box. And then you have until October 15th to send that back to them. And so you can wait until you get your iPhone 5, but at least you've locked in your price today, because we all know that come September 20th, when people start getting these new phones in their hands, they're going to be selling a lot more of them back to Gazelle, and therefore Gazelle's price that they offer is going to go down. So check out Gazelle right now, and there's a little place in there to put that Matt Geekab referred you, and we would appreciate you doing that. And so that's what you do. Go to gazelle.com. That's where it all starts. It's fun.
Well, I just looked. I was able to multitask here, Dave, and actually the dollar amount that they're willing to pay is more than I've seen the other guys willing to pay me.
So that's
it looks
great.
Like they pay top dollar.
Excellent. They do.
I better lock that in.
Yeah, I've used them several times myself, and I'm always happy to be able to use a sponsor. But like you, you know, I always kind of look around, and they do. They continuously have the top price. So yeah, so maybe that's lock it in. There's no harm in doing it if between now and October 15th you do nothing else except throw away the box that they sent you. You're done. That's it. You don't, you know, you're good. You don't owe them anything. They don't owe you anything. It's done. If you happen to send your phone back, they'll pay you what they told you they'd pay for it. So, or if you've lied to them about the condition, well, then they might negotiate you. But they're really fair about it. We've heard from so many listeners how good they are. So check it out. All right. Time to get into some questions here, John.
And answers, yes.
Yeah. Oh, no. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. That's not how it works. So Rinky Dink is where we will start. Or Rinky Dinky? I can't remember. Rinky Dinky. It posted on the Mac Observer forums. The Mac Geekab forums at the Mac Observer. A question that I think we have an answer for. And I'm going to call Rinky Dinky a he, but I could be completely wrong on that. I'm just arbitrarily deciding. So Rinky Dinky writes, he says, hello, I've just joined. So if this question's already, it hasn't been asked. He says, I get PhotoStream and I get how it works. Take pictures on mobile devices and bingo, they're everywhere. However, I just noticed that a large number of pictures that I put on my Mac, 2300, in fact, just for storage, are all now on my mobile devices. I just want to know if I can stop any pictures I put on my Mac from being transferred to all these other devices that are linked to PhotoStream. I thought it was only a one-way sharing by default. And by default, I don't believe it is, but you can change this. You go into iPhoto on your Mac, you go into Preferences, and you choose PhotoStream, which in my version of iPhoto was the fourth button or tab over. I don't know what we're supposed to call those. And inside there is one option that says automatic upload. If you uncheck that, that should accomplish what you want and get you back into the one-way photo stream. And I can totally see where that would be handy. You know, if you don't need all those photos on your iPhone or iDevices and you just have the one Mac, then absolutely, you know, set it to automatic import so that it pulls everything in on your Mac and not automatic upload. So hopefully that helped, Rinky Dinky. And hopefully it helps more, some of you too.
Well, it'll help Aperture people as well, because you pretty much get an identical screen in the same place, Dave. So if you go to Aperture, Preferences, PhotoStream, you will see the same thing. My PhotoStream, automatic import, automatic upload. In my case, I have automatic upload unchecked because I do not want to do that from Aperture.
Right.
And then there's a shared photo stream checkbox as well.
And so it does work the way I assumed, right? If you uncheck that box, you're not pushing things from Aperture
Correct.
Up to PhotoStream. Awesome.
Because I don't want to. I'm okay with consuming mostly pictures I take with my iPhone. I'm okay with consuming those with Aperture. But yeah, I don't want it to, because yeah, like, you know, like a Rinky Dinky or, you know, said, I mean, the thing is, I have thousands of photos and I don't want to waste the bandwidth uploading all of those to PhotoStream because I don't need it. They're
right.
Aperture.
Yeah, right. Right. No, I'm totally with you. I may turn that off on mine too. I got to think about this. Yeah, there's times when I use it though. If I'm trying to get screenshots around, it's actually kind of handy. But yeah.
Well, it is. I mean, you're not chewing data. You're not chewing phone data if you do it from Aperture or iPhoto. So yeah. Well, you're going to chew it downloading it. So, yeah.
Yeah, but I think you can on the iPhone, I think you get to send or set if PhotoStream uses 3G data, right? Okay, now you got me flying by the seat of my pants here, John. So I go to general, cellular, and then at the bottom, so settings on your iPhone, general and cellular. And at the bottom of that pane or page or whatever you want to call it, there is a set of things. Yeah, but no, but it's not here. So no, PhotoStream only uses Wi-Fi. There are, but that is a good spot to look. You can tell it not to use your 3G data for things like, you know, iTunes or iCloud documents if you don't want. Think about that, you know, before you choose it. But you can decide, look, I don't ever want it to download music over cellular data because it's just going to burn up my, my 3G or 4G. So there you go. Yep. But PhotoStream will only ever download over Wi-Fi. So if you have home Wi-Fi bandwidth limits, though, that could be a problem. Mm-hmm. All right, John, you going to take us to Anand?
Anand has a question, and he says, hi, D&J.
Hi, A.
Yo. I wonder if you or listeners can help me with a puzzle of how to scan over a Wi-Fi network. I have a Samsung printer scanner combo machine, model SCX-3405W. I have this connected by USB to a Mac Mini, which is on all the time, and via Printopia, it is accessible by all Macs and iOS devices. This works perfectly. The challenge I have is how to scan over the network. Currently, I use ScreenShare for my MacBook Air and access the scanning software through that. I then save files to a folder, which is shared. Is there a more elegant way where the scanner can be accessed directly from a Mac on the network? And even more amazing, do you know of any iOS-friendly apps, such as Printopia, that would enable me to instruct the scanner from my iPad? I don't know if I can answer the last part, but I can certainly answer the first part, depending on the scanner here, Dave. So one of the cool features of the most recent OS X is that you can share not only printers, but scanners.
Scanners.
Yes, it would depend on, I think the thing is they have to be standards compliant, I think Twain or whatever the heck you call it there. So the question I asked him is, does the scanner appear in the list of devices if you go to System Preferences, Hardware, Print and Scan? I think that's the criteria here. If it does, then you should be able to click on the device, and then you will see in that preference pane an option, share this scanner on the network.
That's right.
You can also enable scanner sharing by going to System Preferences at Sharing and check the scanner sharing box. And then there's an article. I'll post that here. So if it's standards compliant, and this works worked well, I've done it. I actually do it for printing, but it works equally well for scanning. And then what happens is that any other machine on that network, if you do open up the pref pane for scanning and printing, and then you want to add one, if you have shared, if there's a shared one on the network, it will appear in the list of devices, and I think it lists it as Bonjour as the type of technology used to share it.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Yeah. Or at least to advertise that it's sharing it. Yeah, that's right.
Right. So yeah. That's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Works for me. All right, let's move on to Antone. This is one that actually has been in our queue for a little while. Antone writes, I was wondering if you could help me with my external hard drive. I keep getting the error message the disk was not ejected properly. I'm not using a US hub, and the hard drives are self-powered, meaning they are plugged into the wall in addition to USB. I'm not disconnecting the hard drive. I have it plugged in all the time. This has been happening to all my USB hard drives. After a time, this causes the hard drive to die for good. Doesn't happen when I use the hard drive with Windows or Linux. My drives also have FireWire connections, but the MacBook does not have FireWire. I've rebooted the Mac and the external hard drive, but the issue came back after my reboot. I had this issue a few months back when I went on a month-long trip for work, and when I came back, the problem was gone. My coworkers think I should reinstall the OS. I do have a copy of Mountain Lion. I think I may be having a hardware issue with the MacBook. I am running Snow Leopard. Okay, interesting troubleshooting option. I don't know if we're going to nail it, although I think we've heard back from Antoine since then, and I think we might know what's going on. But the way I would head down this path is the first thing I would check, and again, you know, you've probably ruled this out because you've tested it with other machines, but test the power supplies to the that you're using for the hard drives, because if those are flaky or cutting in or out, that would cause this problem. But that's probably not it. Number two, I would check the USB cable itself. Again, you can use the other machines to do this, but it's definitely worth ruling out, because USB cables, you know, we move them around, we flex them, things can happen, and sometimes those can be bad things that happen. The next thing I would check is what else is on the USB bus, right? Where are we with this? You know, what other stuff do you have? And some of that stuff might be internal to your Mac, your Mac, like your FaceTime camera, your keyboard, your trackpad, all that stuff inside your laptop is USB. So check to see, you can use System Profiler. You go to the Apple menu and do hold down the Option key and do System Information is the quickest way to bring that up. And then just click on USB and it will show you everything that's connected. It might mean that moving the device to a different USB port to get it off of the same bus as something else, that might be the magic answer. That would also be the magic answer if you have a hardware problem with a USB port because you're moving it to a different port. You know, running Apple's hardware diagnostics, I've never seen it give a false positive, but I've seen it give a lot of false negatives. So if you run Apple's hardware diagnostics and it says everything's okay, that doesn't necessarily mean everything's okay. But if it says something's wrong, something is wrong. So that would be another interesting thing. We did hear back from Antone, and he says at first he did upgrade to Mountain Lion, and he looked at the console and there were still errors from the old OS. So he unplugged all of his external drives. He opened up the terminal and deleted everything from his hard drive with a terminal command that deletes everything, which is kind of weird. He says after the upgrade, the drive still didn't work. Then I switched the USB cable and that fixed it. He says, I guess that goes to show you try the easy stuff first. So there we go. Solution number two solved it. Yeah. Which I didn't think would because he had tried it, but maybe the Mac was pickier about that. You know, who knows?
Well, or it could have been a intermittent connection, which, I mean, what's happening is when the drive, one thing that could be happening, and it sounds like in this case it was, is that the drive is losing power and it disappears off the bus and then the computer complains about it.
Well, not losing power, but losing its signal to the computer.
Right.
Well, it's still being powered. I mean, if it was the USB cable,
right. It's externally
not
powered. Okay,
correct.
I got it.
Correct.
All right. So for a drive that's powered by the USB cable, it could be, mm-hmm. But it boils down to that a cable that is damaged in some way could break the connection. And then, you get this message.
Okay. And it's possible his Windows machine's USB bus is more tolerant of losing a device for, you know, let's say, you know, the Mac says if I don't see this for more than, you know, 15 milliseconds, consider it gone. Whereas the Windows machine, that USB bus says I'll give it 100 milliseconds before I report back that it's gone. And that might be enough. Right. I mean, that's, you know, flaky cable on one.
Right.
Yep.
Yep. And a final way to solve problems like this, though it didn't apply in this case, but some devices, like we had a Garmin device in the past, the firmware may be flaky. In this case, it didn't apply, but just to throw that out there, if you have a device that where you're getting this message, see if they have a firmware update that could prevent this behavior.
So. Yeah, totally. 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 All right. Let's see, where are we with this? We have Jeff up next, and I'm having trouble finding his question. Do we have it? We have it in the Dropbox here, John, which we use to share sometimes. Did it make it there?
I have it.
You do? Okay. Then I'm sure I have it too. I just don't know why it's not in your Jumbo
form. Well, let me read it.
I got it. That's in front of me.
Good.
Jeff writes, I have a problem that's driving me nuts. I have an iPhone 5 that's syncing with an iTunes library on my Windows PC. iTunes is only syncing a single playlist. My issue is this. When I manually delete a song, artist, or album from my phone via the music app on the phone and sync with iTunes, iTunes will then restore the deleted song, artist, or album. I have Googled around and various sites indicate that I must uncheck each song, artist, or album from my music library that I no longer wish to be synced. While this may work, it seems highly inefficient, more so in my case, since I have 80,000 plus songs. Is there a better way? Yeah, I've run into this too, and I agree with you, Jeff. I don't think unchecking is the necessary path, although it may be a workaround in your case and sometimes in mine. I think it's supposed to work the way that you're trying to do it. Once you delete something on the phone, it should then not sync it back. And I've seen it not just with songs, but I've seen it with apps. A lot of times I'll, you know, go through my iPhone and, you know, I collect apps, right? You know, testing things or whatever. I just install a lot of stuff. And so I'll go through sometimes on a Saturday afternoon and just delete 15 apps. And then I go and sync my phone with my computer, which I don't do all that often because the computer's asleep at night and when it plugs in. So I go and sync it with the computer and it puts all these apps back out there. It's like, oh no, I make them go away. And what I have found to solve this is, or what I believe causes it, is that when the phone and the computer are not in sync to start. And as I said, mine, I don't sync very often with my computer. So when I do it, it's starting too far in the past and it thinks that changes were made on the computer after they were made on the phone and they're out of sync. So before I delete any apps now, I sync with my computer and I do it twice just to get everything happy without making any changes on either side. Then I make one change and I sync again and I test it. And if that works, then I head down the path of deleting lots and lots of things. But it sometimes takes 3 or 4 syncs to get it to stop doing it. I've seen it do it with TV shows on my iPad, movies. It just wants to put this stuff out there that I've said, no, I don't want it synced. And it just takes time and several syncs. Now, obviously, there's a bug somewhere, but, you know, we can't fix that. So that's what I do. Have you ever seen it, John?
Not really. The only thought I have here is that, Dave, when I'm looking here at my iPhone, so I do see within iTunes a couple of things. So when you click on the device, you're going to get a number of different places with different data. You're going to get the phone data, backups, and then there's an options section, Dave. And I do see some options here, which you may want to examine and may be influencing this behavior. So one of them I see is called sync only checked songs and videos. And on my system, that's unchecked.
Okay. It shouldn't matter though, but yeah, I mean, that should just limit the amount of things that are eligible for syncing. Not
right. Right.
Right. Right. I mean, you know,
all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then actually I'm, you know, like I mentioned, I'm set up. I actually have a checkbox next to manually manage music and videos. I prefer to do the manual thing versus letting the phone take care of it. So,
yeah. And you don't do iTunes Match for music, right?
Correct.
Okay. That's a handy thing. That's a handy thing. And I am looking forward to iTunes Radio. I have not put any of the developer builds of iOS 7 on my phone. But now that the GM is out, which I think it is, I may head down that path. But I'm going to replace my phone tomorrow. It's been having that SIM card problem where it says no SIM installed. And I've got 10 days left on the warranty. So we're going to take it down there and swap it out tomorrow afternoon. Cool. Yeah. All right. Let's go to Pierre has an interesting tip. Let's see if that one is where I think it is. It is. All right. And Pierre writes, let me make sure I've got it. Okay. He says, I have a MacBook Pro Retina 15 early 2013 running Mac OS 10 Mountain Lion 10.8.4. Most of the time it's in clamshell mode connected to a 27-inch Apple display with an Apple Bluetooth keyboard and trackpad. But when I use it without the accessories, the lid open and with the lid open, I suddenly encounter problems. At first, the internal keyboard and trackpad won't respond. When the display dims before going to sleep, movement of the trackpad doesn't wake it. Frantically clicking or hitting keys eventually wakes it, but this takes time. I did some testing. With the lid open, letting it go to sleep with the Bluetooth stuff nearby will produce the same result. The internal keyboard does not wake it right away, but the Bluetooth does. I also tried a different brand new user and the same result surfaces. It seems like the internal input devices go to sleep and I can't get them to wake up. We went through round and round and Pierre finally came back with the answer. He says, I decided after talking to Apple that concluded it was a hardware problem. He says, I decided to reinstall the OS from the recovery partition right on top of the existing system. No nuke and pave, just a what I would call a maintenance reinstall. And he says, all the problems were solved. So we are, you know, we used to do this with Windows a lot back in the late 90s when it would get wonky. We would do a maintenance reinstall of Windows, same version right on top of itself, then let it run all the updates. And a lot of times that would put something back in place that had gotten out of whack. In his case, I'm thinking there was some USB driver or something, human interface driver that was corrupted or semi-corrupted, and the maintenance reinstall solved it. So it's a good reminder for all of us that this is a potential solution to these problems. Right? Yeah. It's good stuff. Yes? No? Thoughts?
When in doubt, reset.
When in doubt, reset. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I don't think we shared this last show, but I had an email exchange with a user and we did something like just reboot or, you know, it was one of these solutions that just solved it, but shouldn't have solved it. And he wrote me, he's like, what do you think that was going on? Should I worry about this, you know, happening again? And I said, no, my feeling on this stuff is the first, if you have a problem once and a quick restart or something like that fixes it and it doesn't immediately come back, don't worry about it unless it comes back a second time. Then fix it and then worry about why it's coming back. But if it only happens once, don't drive yourself crazy. That's my advice. Free, you know, right here. Just extra bonus. All right. Our second sponsor, John, is one that I am glad to have back, and that is CrashPlan. CrashPlan is one of my certainly my favorite. It's the one I use. They're an online backup service, and they do some cool things. First of all, you go to CrashPlan, you download the software, and you can set up an account there and upload your data to them. They allow you to seed your data if you want to mail them a hard drive as opposed to using your bandwidth to send up to them. But they, you know, any way you want to get them your data, you get it up to them. Your data is encrypted not only in the stream, right? We talked about this last time, but the stream might be compromised, right? At least by the NSA. Your data is also, the payload is also encrypted. And it stays encrypted on their servers. And you can choose to do it in one of two ways. You can do it using their key, which means they could decrypt it, but they can also help you decrypt it in case you lose your password. And the other way to do it is to use your own key. And then you got to remember that stuff because they can't help you. But it also means the NSA can't help you or can't get to your data. So they will allow you to do that. And you just upload the data to their servers. They've got plans for multiple computers if you've got multiple machines in your house. And if you have multiple machines in your house, you can actually create a second set of backups from CrashPlan machine to CrashPlan machine. Every computer that runs the CrashPlan software can become a backup destination of its own. And what that means is John and I could both upload to CrashPlan, but then we could also send data to each other. Like we could each hang a hard drive or like Pete and I, we hang Drobos at Pilot Pete and I hang Drobos off at each other's homes. And we use CrashPlan that way too. And it's this extra layer of security. If I want to get a quick file back, I can do that online at CrashPlan. But if I need all my data back, I can run over to Pete's house and there it is. And I don't have to wait for it to all download. I just drive my Drobo home and I restore. So I highly recommend checking it out. It's very cool. I have it running on all my Macs and it runs great. And it's, like I said, it's easy to talk about because I use it every single day, sometimes multiple times on both computers, backing up once to CrashPlan and at the cloud and once to Pete with the private cloud, but all using my key. So Pete can't even read my data. So it's good stuff. We love CrashPlan. Check it out. CrashPlan.com is the place to go. And if they ask you, tell them Mac Geek Cab sent you. We would appreciate that. Good stuff. You used CrashPlan for a while, right, John?
Yes.
Yeah. It's good.
Didn't even know it was there. That's the way it should be.
That's
just sits there in the background, just backs up your stuff. I think once I had to retrieve a file that I accidentally deleted, and it was there. So
that's the right. That's the idea. Yeah, I do recommend with any backup, be it CrashPlan or anything else. Once you get your backup in place and you feel good that it's uploading and or copying or however you're doing your backup, practice. Try a restore. Not only to confirm that it does it. I mean, I can tell you CrashPlan does it. John just told you CrashPlan does it. They're reliable. They know what they're doing there. But the real question is, do you know how to do it? Because when you need your data, it's probably crunch time. And you don't want to have to be reading through, how do I restore my data? What button do I click? It's pretty easy with CrashPlan, but it's worth, you know, when you're in panic situation, it's nice to have been through the process. So it's not new to you. Not that it's difficult, but it is nice for it to be something familiar when you're in panic mode. So that's my feeling.
Well, actually, I remember, and then we can move on here. Yeah, but I remember that one great feature is that, so this was during the superstorm, I guess they called it here.
Mm-hmm.
But I was out of commission, like many people in my area. We didn't have power for several weeks.
Right.
Though I did have power for the computer, but my internet and stuff was kind of up and down and up and down. And what it will do is that if it does not phone home during the time period that you schedule it, it'll send you an email saying, yeah, by the way, I wasn't able to back up your stuff. Is everything okay? And that's a really nice. It's nice. Again, it doesn't happen unless you need it to.
Right.
But it was basically saying, I haven't backed up your stuff. You may want to see what's wrong with your network or yell at the power company to get your power back on.
Well, no, that's a handy thing because, like John said, he didn't think about it. It just worked. And when that happens, you stop thinking about it. You stop worrying about it. You stop thinking to check to see if your backup works. For the first month, yeah, you're all over it. Then after a while, you're just like, oh, yeah, it works. You don't stop worrying about it. So it's nice to have that safety net of an email saying, hey, check this out. You might have some problem. All right. That's CrashPlan.com. And thanks to them, too. All right. Interesting question. I love this next one. Well, Michael writes, he says, in the latest podcast, Dave mentioned that he can rip Blu-ray discs to his Mac. He says, I can rip regular DVDs with handbrake and use my Apple SuperDrive. I'm unaware of a Mac way to rip Blu-ray or play those discs on a Mac. Help me, Mr. Wizard. So, Michael, I don't have the ability to rip Blu-ray on my Mac, but I would actually like it, for the reasons I mentioned in the last show. It's really nice to just manage my music or my movie collection that way. But the reason is I lack the hardware to do it. Handbrake will do it. And OWC sells drives that will rip and play, but rip Blu-ray discs. So you can check it out. They've got a little article there on OWC that we will put into the show notes, and we'll go from there. But I mean, they've got drives in like the $100 range that will do this, and you can check them out and decide what speeds you want and all that good stuff. So highly recommend checking it out. It's very interesting. I like it. It's good. So that's the answer to that question. I got to get one. Because
Blu-ray?
Yeah. I mean, I got to get a Blu-ray reader. One. Yeah, I have a Blu-ray DVD player.
Yeah.
I got to get a reader for the computer so I can put it in my movie
now,
library.
That makes me wonder. So I got a very basic one. I think it's a Sylvania. I wonder if there's a way I can pop it open and make it work with my computer. Probably not, but.
why couldn't, I mean, if it's got a.
Well, it depends on the interface.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if mine has a SATA port, but I mean it. Yeah, I think it would depend on what interface they're using to connect the Blu-ray player to whatever processor or embedded system they have in this thing. But
yeah,
I may have to hang an ugly cable out of it. But what the heck?
That's a good idea.
No, my criteria for getting a Blu-ray player was as soon as they go below $100, that's when I threw down the cash to get one. And actually, I got one, Dave, without the annoying BD Live. I hate that feature. It's so freaking annoying.
What's
like,
this?
I don't. A lot of Blu-ray players have something called BD Live, which will reach out over the internet and grab content, dynamic content and stuff like that. And it's like, I don't want you to do that.
Oh, interesting.
I just want you to be a disc player, okay?
I will say this, and I'm with you. I think I waited longer than you did to get a Blu-ray player. In fact, I know I did. But we wound up doing the same thing. You know, less than $100. I think we paid $69 for us or whatever. I didn't have this problem because I connect everything at my house. If it's got an Ethernet port, it's got a cable in it, right? It's wired up and it's on the network. And that's really handy because a lot of Blu-ray players can do things like play Amazon Video or, you know, Hulu sometimes, Netflix, etc. But the other thing they can do is update their firmware. And this gets really important when new movies come out, because I was at my father-in-law's house. They were out for the evening. We were down in Florida at their house. This was last winter or something. And we rented a movie to watch, and we couldn't play it because their DVD, their Blu-ray player didn't have the latest firmware that allowed it to unlock this DVD. And so we had to, we resorted to alternate means to watch the movie. I think Torrent may have been used. I'm not sure, somehow, but listen, yeah. We rented the movie. We wanted to play the stupid thing. And we couldn't, so I found another way to play the movie, and then we deleted it, and I don't feel bad about that, yeah. Right? You know, we just here we are. Yeah.
I saw an article online. I think it was a fish shake against the certain model of Samsung Blu-ray player, where it has this problem where they promised a firmware update, and it's been months and months, and people are basically stuck with, a device that doesn't play their disc, which to me is, I've never had that happen.
Yeah. Well, because yours is probably connected, right?
No, it's not. No, I've done, this one I actually did. I think I did one manual update. So you got to download a bin file and then burn it on a disk and you stuff it in there. And it's like, oh, this is a firmware update. Okay. I think I had to do one firmware update, but I've never had a disk that did not play.
Okay.
So I got kind of lucky.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Right. Yeah, it was very frustrating. And it was a good movie too. We were going to, it was Castaway. Which I loved. And we were out to dinner and we were telling the kids about it. And they're like, oh yeah, we should get it. So we went to a movie store or whatever, you know, I don't know, Hollywood Video or
fun.
So anyway.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm actually in the middle. It actually shut down and it paused, but I actually today, so they just released Star Trek Into Darkness on Blu-ray at Redbox. I reserved it at like 1 a.m. I'm like, I got to get this.
That's awesome.
It's cool so far. But yeah, it shut down like halfway because I had to do this podcast thing. So,
well, you know, you got something to look forward to when you,
I like it so far. It has the same energy as the other, ones.
Yeah. This is the most recent one that was just in the theaters, right?
Yeah.
We saw that one in the theater. I thought that was awesome. Good. We have a theater near us. If you can find a theater near you that lets you reserve seats, it changes everything, dude. Yeah. Hmm. Our theater, it's small. It's this new multiplex or whatever. And the rooms are small and they may only have like 8 or 15 seats that can be reserved total in the theater. And then everything else is just, you know, general admission like normal. But it is so nice for a 7 o'clock movie to get to the theater at 6:55 and go sit down and watch the movie. It's so much better than like the stress. I worry about
especially
this
if
stuff.
You're a family and it's a first and it's a if you're a family and you all want to sit together and it's a first run, you know, film, then it kind of sucks if you have to.
Yeah, but I even worry about it just for me. I don't like to have a bad vantage point. Even like when I'm at South by Southwest, I always make sure I get up in front of the line so that I can get a good seat and be comfortable and watch the movie. You know, and it sucks because you got to wait an extra, 45 minutes in line to do that or whatever for popular stuff. So this, it's so much better. And for our theater, anyway, the one near us here in Epping, New Hampshire, it's the same price. Reserved seats are the same price in advance as everything else. So it changes everything about going to the movies. I went years without going to the movies because I just, hated it because of that. And now we go all the time. So anyway, I digress. I'm hyper today, John. I don't know what
it is. It's a tangent. Well, yeah. you're on TV, man.
That's true. I did just finish doing a segment on Bloomberg TV. So I think that will be, it was live when I did it, but I think it will be put up as a segment. I did it with Pim Fox on Taking Stock, I think is the name of his show. But we talked about the Apple announcements and stuff. It's fun.
Which sadly, I think their stock, last I looked, they took about a 10-point hit.
They lost they closed about 2.25% down. But there was one point Pim was saying that they were down to a 4-month low at some point during the day. It's crazy. Whatever. It always happens after an announcement.
Well, an announcement that doesn't wow.
Correct.
Analysts. Correct. I'm sorry, analysts.
Yeah, and that was, we went through some of that on the on Bloomberg today, because there was this other woman on who was saying that she felt, and I'm sorry, I don't have her name. I don't get to watch it while I do it because they don't want to send me a stream and use bandwidth because we did it over Skype. So I did not get this woman's full name. I will. And my apologies to her if she's listening. But she was saying, she's not my friend anyway, I'm sure, after I told her this, but she was saying that Apple, you know, is a consumer electronics company, and it's just, you know, she doesn't see that any of this new stuff matters. And I stopped her and I said, it's a mistake. I didn't stop her, but when I had my chance to speak, I said, it's a mistake to write Apple off as just another consumer electronics company. Yes, they make consumer electronics, but if you follow the history of Apple in any way, you know that they have a way of kind of sneaking up on you. And we talked about some of those sneaker, you know, those sleeper features, like the fingerprint scanning, the Touch ID. Well, that's a sleeper feature.
So. Well, what was said, I believe, is partially correct. They are, one part of them is, in fact, a consumer electronics company. But they're also a software company. They're also a hardware company. They're also a, they're many different companies.
That's right.
And this is one facet of them. But I wouldn't say that's all they are. No, in that case, I would agree.
No, and you can't even, and they don't operate in silos either. So you can't say, well, the consumer electronics division of Apple does this and the software division does that. I mean, it's, they make products, right? And they, it's one team.
Oh,
I
no,
mean,
no. They yeah. make solutions.
There you go. That's right. And that's what I was saying. I said all these things that they added to the 5S, it's convenience, right? And it's great. Convenience because the camera's better. It's convenience with Touch ID. But be careful, because they snuck stuff in with Touch ID that I think we're going to see kind of percolate down the road. But we already talked about that. Mm-hmm. All right. Speaking of stuff we've already talked about, Mike tweeted us and he said, you talked about personal cloud in show 464. He says, I use a service called Tonido for personal cloud. Now, Tonido is interesting. It uses your Mac. So we talked about using OwnCloud and things like that. And there's actually a short-term problem with OwnCloud where they're not letting you install it on Macs because of some Unicode incompatibility. But Tonido's available. Now, Tonido has an interesting, they have a freemium model. The data always stays with you, okay? But their software is their business, whereas like Dropbox gives away their software and you then pay for storage beyond a certain amount. Tonido, you own the storage, but you need to pay for the software, but it's way cheaper than Dropbox. The free plan, you can sync up to 2 gigabytes of data in a shared folder. You can, but you can also use Tonido to access all the data on your Mac from remote, and there's no limit on that. And then for $29 a year, you can sync 100 gigs and also access all your stuff from remote. And then you, for $200 a year, they've got all kinds of crazy stuff. But so I thought that was an interesting solution. They're just writing software. So you know that they're going to be up to date on features and all that stuff because the software is their business. That's all they write. They don't, you know, they don't host your data. So, at least not with that product. I think they've got others where they might, but with this, it's, you know, your data. And if John and I used Tonido, our data would sync between our two Macs. It would never touch their servers. So I think their servers are just used to, you know, make sure we know who each other is and poke holes in our firewalls, and then they're out of it. So that's cool. It's cool. Tonido. And it's called Tonido Desktop is the product that, listener Mike pointed out to us. So. Thank you for that. Yes, John.
I think next we have.
Yeah, you're right. I'll give it the intro. So we've talked about security, and while we're in our kind of follow-up mode here, we're going to have, at least for now, sort of, we're going to put a bow on this email security conversation. But there are a couple of points that have come up as questions, and also just in conversations between John and I, that we wanted to share with you. So we will use some of these questions to kind of get there, but hopefully we can do this succinctly because we're already at the hour mark, John. So,
yes. I'll get through these as quick as
we can. Yeah, go ahead. I don't think we need to read all of the questions. I think we can encapsulate. And if you want me to do some of that, fine. If you want to do it, go ahead.
All right. Well, the first question, if I could encapsulate it. So it's from Jürgen.
Yep.
And so this is something that I think we may not have effectively communicated here, or rather the tools that you use may not necessarily tell you what's happening here.
To be fair, I had the same question that you're about to, and I made the same assumption that Jürgen made incorrectly initially. So it resonates with me. Go. Sorry, I'm interrupting.
Yeah. So Jürgen basically said, so what we talked about in the past was this concept of public key cryptography, when you start the process, you generate two keys, a private key, which is your key that you got to keep secret and it's all yours, and then a public key. And then you go through the process of sending this public key off somewhere and it gets signed by a certificate authority or a CA. And that's how the process works. But the question is, who generates this public and private key pair? And his concern, and I would agree with him, is that at least when you use a browser to initiate this process, it's not clear where these keys are being generated. Now, if they're following the spec and they're doing what they should, what happens is that when you request a certificate, behind the scenes, your browser or your computer, or it's the browzer or the OS, one or the other, they're generating this key pair. Remember, public, private key, two keys. And then what happens is when you go to a CA, it sends the public portion over the network, securely we would hope. It gets signed and then returned to you as a certificate.
That's right.
So I agree with him. Now, his paranoid part said, well, how do I know that this is really happening? And my answer to him was, well, at least when you do it with a browser, you really don't know if that's really happening. For all you know, it could be generated on the other end. Okay.
Well,
again, it's putting on my tinfoil hat.
No, I'm with you.
There's nothing when you go through this process, there's nothing that the average user can do to prove to themselves that it is in fact happening on their system. So I will agree with him. It's unclear. I would actually prefer the browser says, hi, you know what? I'm generating a key pair now. Okay. And then we're going to send it off. But it doesn't tell you that. I think they did it because they don't want to confuse people or with the terminology or just, because most people would be like, I don't know what this means.
Actually, I'll back up. I think the reason they did it was they never expected non-geeks to worry about this stuff, right? I mean, our browsers, and up until now, that's basically what it's been. In fact, even you and I, we started playing with S/MIME security stuff a couple of years ago. We actually started playing with it back in 1997 together, but it's been on and off. We just hasn't been a priority, right? And then recently it's sort of like, oh, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should worry about this stuff more regularly. But what the way that you can make yourself feel better about this is when you go to a certificate authority, you send your request to them and then they email you a link. And that email is the process by which they confirm that you actually own the email address that you said you owned. And once you can click that link, proving that you've got access to that email address, you then download from them a file and you add that file to your keychain. And then suddenly you have the ability to sign your mail. It is. And it was my assumption initially. I think it was your assumption too, John, and Bart Bouchot's sort of set us straight. He said that, it's a safe assumption. You get that file and put it in your keychain. That's your certificate pair. So I assume that the certificate authority generated the whole thing, had my private key and sent it to me. Wrong. What happened was my computer generated it. And the only thing I'm downloading from the certificate authority is this certificate, but not the public or the private key. Those were generated on my computer, but the reason you don't see that happen is because when you use Safari to do this, it stores that stuff in your keychain when Safari generates it. So when you get this certificate from the authority, you add that to your keychain, and now the puzzle is complete and you've got everything. But there's no obvious, like John said, it doesn't tell you, hey, I generated a key pair and stored it in your keychain, but it does, and that's how it works. So yeah, it's a fair question. Yeah.
And I would say it's a fault in the UI because using something like GPG tools, and this is what I wrote to him, I like GPG because it tells you, okay, I am now generating a key pair for you. Okay. Do you get this? So it explicitly tells you that this is being generated on your computer, whereas the browser does not. So we'll close it out. But we won't.
I'm not going to let you get away with that, because you're saying GPG Tools is better because it tells you that it's generating it on your computer. But you also, when you were talking about S/MIME, you're talking about the average user. Using GPG is not something any average user will do these days. So
all I'm saying is that their UI tells you where the key pair is being generated. Okay.
Yeah. But it doesn't tell you, it doesn't, and then you upload it to a server, right? I mean, the same kind of thing happens. I wouldn't say that either one of them is, I mean, it's just, you know, it's
all I'm saying this is geek is stuff. They tell, okay, but all I'm saying is they tell you where it's happening and the other system doesn't. But we just set everybody straight. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, S/MIME is fully secure. You're generating both keys locally and only sending up the certificate to be signed. And then it comes back and you're good to go. Yeah.
Right.
That's good.
Okay.
Okay.
Next now, question.
Yep. Dovetailing
quickly,
right
let's
in.
Let's go to Scott here. Okay. So Scott had a question and he basically said, well, if you exchange certificates with whatever server, couldn't the NSA or other third party have access to your certificate to decrypt your email as if it was a trusted recipient? Okay. And what we have to do here is very clearly. So I think, again, I understand the confusion here. The thing is, you have to. So we talked before, public, private key. Now, let's review what a certificate is. A certificate is a public key signed by a certificate authority's private key. And this is by design. Having someone's public key does not give you the ability to decrypt or verify a signature.
And having the certificate authority's private key does not allow you to decrypt email encrypted with the user's public key. So if I use, say, Komodo, I send my certificate around. It's signed with Komodo's private key. But I never see their private key. They never see mine. And messages that are encrypted with my public key are not decryptable by anyone, including Komodo, other than me.
Correct. So again, we ought to be very clear that a certificate only contains a public key.
That's right.
Signed by a private key.
The short answer is, unless you with S/MIME, you would do this by going into your keychain and exporting what's known as a P12 file. Unless you generate a P12 file or share your Mac's keychain with someone else, you have never shared your public key with anyone. It would not happen by accident. Again, unless if somebody has a full backup of your machine, then and they know your login keychain password, then yes, they do have your private key. But otherwise, no. Yeah.
And actually, that's to his question. So he asked the question, can I read encrypted email within Gmail's web interface? And the answer is, as Dave said, in order to read encrypted email that's meant for you, whatever system you're using, whether it be a web interface or another computer, needs to have your private key. How do you get that to another computer? Via one of these P12 files, or a personal information exchange file, which is a password protected, or it really should be.
Yeah.
This is the dangerous part. When you're trying to distribute your private key to other systems, it's going to be in this P12 file, and they're going to say, by the way, I need a password to protect this. You could certainly not use a password, though. To me, that's silly. Yeah.
For example, John and I, you know, I generated an S/MIME key for actually two of them for us here for Mac Geekup for feedback and for premium for the email addresses so that we could communicate securely with you folks. But then I had to share the private key with John, and I had to intently do that. And I did. I shared it with a P12 and I put a password in there, because otherwise you all could decrypt it. Now, that wouldn't be that big of a deal, except it would breach a trust thing that happens between us and you, and that's bad. So there you go.
Right. Okay. And the last question here. So I made a statement that was not entirely incorrect, but I want to set people straight here, because we had people write to me about this.
You were wrong. It's okay. But it's okay.
No, I wasn't.
I love giving you a hard time about being wrong.
It was a order of magnitude. So the thing is, my statement was that a RSA key that is thousands of bits is more secure than a symmetric key that is hundreds of bits. And that statement is
false.
True. No, it's true. But you got to think orders of it. But what was pointed out to me is that I did not mention the orders of magnitude in this case. OK. And very quickly, so from a mathematical point of view here, when you try to, well, the thing is, if you try to crack either of these systems using brute force, then what I said is entirely true, is that if you try to brute force something that's thousands of bits versus hundreds of bits, it's going to take you longer. The thing is, public key cryptography is not something that you, if you want to crack it smartly, you don't use brute force. The thing is, it uses something called, I think, a discrete log. Basically, it's taking two prime numbers, multiplying them and coming up with a bigger prime number. So the thing is, the way to hack a public key system that's thousands of bits long is you're trying to find two prime numbers. So basically the thing is an equivalent, and we have a link to an article here at RSA. So the thing is, one figure that they mentioned here is that, okay, a 256-bit secret or symmetric key is roughly equivalent to a 15,000-bit RSA key.
Right.
So in order to get equivalent security, you're going to need an RSA key that's, two orders of magnitude larger than a symmetric key. So just to clarify that, because again, you're solving different problems. The math is different.
In short, to sum all of this up from where we started with where your key is generated to where the differences in the symmetric and the asymmetric keys, in short, using S/MIME, using PGP or GPG tools for the Mac, both of these, super secure. If you've encrypted your data with these, or if someone has encrypted data for you with these, because they're public keys, you're the only one that has the ability to decrypt those, short of someone doing a brute force attack, and even that's pretty secure.
The only thing I'm going to differ with you on this is that, assuming that someone has not inserted a backdoor into your system and has observed the key generation process, and that has been hinted at some articles.
Well, sure. If somebody has access to your Mac and you have a virus running on there, then sure. Yes. If someone intercepts the key generation process, yes, of course.
Or observes it and sees you generating your private key, then you lose. Just like if this P12 file is compromised, then you lose. You may even want to be super paranoid and disconnect your computer from the network if you're generating keys.
That's not a bad idea.
So thanks for the questions. And I think that is the end of our secure email chapter, but it was a great discussion.
Well, it's the end of it in terms of taking up showtime with it, at least for the next, half a dozen episodes or so. But if you have any questions, or certainly if you want to communicate with us securely, just email us and we will share our public key with every reply that we send out going forward. We've been doing it for the last couple of weeks. We will continue doing it. So as soon as you get an email from us, if you're using mail on the Mac, you will then have our public key in your keychain, and you can encrypt mail being sent to us if you go through the steps we talked through last time about setting up S/MIME. So awesome. All right. And I think with that, John, it is... It's
about that time.
It is about that time. Yeah.
No, it is that time.
It is that time. It's past that time, in fact. The time has already started. All right. Let's see. I already mentioned it once, John. feedback@macgeekab.com is the email address to which you can send in your questions, tips, comments, securely or insecurely, as you may choose.
I would just want to refine that a bit, Dave, is that I really think you meant to say feedback@macgeekgab.com.
And I do mean that, unless you are a premium subscriber, in which case the second email address I mentioned earlier, premium@macgeekgab.com, is the address that you want to send that to. And we do prioritize answers to that address, but we do try to get to everything.
Brilliant. But there are so many other ways to contact us.
I don't want to stop, though. All of you who are premium subscribers that hit your first goal, by the time, in fact, I think most of you probably have them by now, certainly those of you that are in the U.S., should have received your premium gifts. We've been starting to get tweets from people and people sending in pictures. There's a picture up on Facebook of the Mac Geek Gab water bottles that we put together for all of you. There's a little note inside that John and I put together for you. But they have been sent out. The all the U.S. stuff was sent out, I think, on Friday. So that would be Friday the 6th.
Right? From where?
From Connecticut. So
where's mine? I didn't get mine yet.
I know you. I think you and I were sent last. I think you and I are actually being sent with the, when they do the.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. So anyway, so we've got all that stuff is out. The international stuff is being sent this week. In fact, that may have been finished today, if not today, tomorrow. So that's coming too. The goal was to have everything delivered by the end of this week. Certainly domestic stuff should be, and then the international stuff.
And to answer the question, Dave, what is premium? Premium is a way where you can, through a small monetary contribution, show your appreciation for the show.
Yes, that's right. And we have various ways of doing it. Once you have hit $100 in donations, you then qualify for a premium gift like we just talked about. And you can hit that as quickly or as slowly as you want. This time took us a long time to get these gifts processed, but now we know what we're doing. And next time we'll go much, much, much faster. So I think we're probably going to do one in several months. I don't think we're going to wait too much longer to do the next round.
I learned more than I needed to learn about doing email.
Yeah.
Mass emails.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's good. It's good.
And parsing data and databases and all that fun stuff.
Yeah. We do appreciate your patience with that. I know it took a lot longer than I expected, and I know it took longer than you folks expected, so thank you. All right, so that's premium, MattGeekab.com. You can learn all about it right there. If you want to call us, you can call us at 206-666-GEEK, which is, John?
43-35. But that's not all, Dave. We are on the Twitters. And as far as the Twitters are concerned, I am John Epron. He is Dave Hamilton. That other guy is Pilot Pete. The podcast is Mac Geek Gab, and the publication is Mac Observer, all at Twitter.com.
That's right. You can find us on Facebook, Facebook.com/MacGeekGab. Like I said, there's somebody had shared a picture of a water bottle that we put on our page there. But you can also find the events for when we do these live shows. I do want to say hi to everybody in the chat room at MacGeekGab.com/stream. We are normalizing back to Sundays now that we've kind of gotten through this a little bit here. And my family, kids, sport, craziness schedule is settling into something I can somewhat predict. It's all good.
So I may throw a monkey wrench in the works, but we'll see. I won't go into too much detail.
All right. Okay. But next show is on Sunday morning, and actually I think the next four shows are Sunday mornings for us, for Eastern time, for those of you that that's good.
I'm going to grind the coffee.
Yeah, it's good.
I'm going to start now.
That's good. I know. We like it. That's good. All right. Yeah, that's it. I do want to shout out thanks to Michael Johnston from We Have Communicators. He's the one that converts this and adds all the chapters and all that great stuff. So thank you, Michael. He hosts that podcast, and then he also publishes GetAppLure.com. Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, provides all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes BB Edit and Yojimbo from Barebone Software, Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, all from Smile, Gazelle.com, where you can sell your stuff back and get your price locked through 10/15, and also Squarespace at MGG9 gets you 20% off, and then CrashPlan.com. And I think that does it, John. With all this talk about security, you gotta share some advice, though.
If you want to be secure, then you want to make sure you don't get caught.
Made up.